the show where we share our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 70, Astral Weeks, A Secret History of 1968. Hi, I'm Jake.
And I'm Nikki. We have another author interview this week. Ryan Walsh joins us to discuss Boston in 1968, the James Brown concert that might have prevented a riot, a cult that took over Roxbury's Fort Hill, the strange history of LSD in our city, and a musical movement called the Bosstown Sound. Most of all, though, we'll discuss his book Astral Weeks, A Secret History of 1968, and the Van Morrison record that inspired it. But before we sit down and chat with Ryan, it's time to take a look at this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
If you're a fan of Massachusetts history and you've never been to the Commonwealth Museum, now's the time to go. It's our official state history museum, and the state archives are located in the same facility. The main exhibit takes a visitor through Massachusetts history from the arrival of English colonists in the 17th century through the early 20th century, and they have a secondary rotating exhibit in the lobby as well. At the time of this recording and running through April 1st, the lobby exhibit is Celebrating Roxbury, Today and in Historical Memory, which is described on the website. Roxbury has an impressive historical legacy and vibrant tradition of community activism. Using original photographs by artist Anthony W. Lanier, a new lobby exhibit at the Commonwealth Museum celebrates this unique story. Historical institutions are featured, including the 12th Baptist Church, where then-divinity student Martin Luther King Jr. preached and met his future wife Coretta Scott King. Also included are photos of prominent visitors to Roxbury, including Congressman John Lewis, an icon of the civil rights movement, and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson, whose work explored the African-American experience. The exhibit also highlights present-day Roxbury, from construction of the Islamic Center of New England to the annual Berkeley Beantown Jazz Festival. However, the real reason to visit, the exhibit that makes the Commonwealth Museum a can't-miss activity for the history nerd, is their Treasures Gallery. In a dimly lit, climate-controlled room, key founding documents for our Commonwealth and our nation are displayed behind bulletproof glass. In the gallery, you'll find the original 1629 charter for the Massachusetts Bay Colony that was issued to John Winthrop and carried to the New World on the Arabella. Next to it is the 1691 charter of William and Mary that reinstituted the right of self-government in Massachusetts after the Glorious Revolution in England. My hands tremble just looking at them. They also hold the original copy of the Constitution of Massachusetts, written by John Adams and ratified in 1780. This document was the model for our federal constitution, and the copy on display is the canonical source. Every printed copy you've ever seen of the state constitution traces its roots back to a transcription of these yellowing sheets.
Along with these important documents for the founding of our Commonwealth, there are documents significant to the history of the United States. In 1789, Speaker of the House Frederick Muhlenberg and Vice President John Adams signed official copies of the first amendments to the new U.S. Constitution. One copy was kept by Congress, and the other 13 were sent out to states to review and approve. The Massachusetts copy of what we now call the Bill of Rights, one of only 8 surviving copies, is on display at the museum. Similarly, in 1777, Congress ordered that official copies of the Declaration of Independence be printed for presentation to each state. The Massachusetts copy, complete with a handwritten signature by John Hancock, rounds out the collection in the Treasures Gallery. Just outside the gallery, on a pedestal under glass, is one last treasure. The original copper plate created by Paul Revere and used to print his famous engraving portraying the bloody massacre in King Street, March 5, 1770. The museum is located right on the water on Columbia Point in Dorchester, just behind the campus of UMass Boston. There's a small amount of free parking available and pay lots for when that fills up. If you're going via public transit, take the Red Line to the JFK UMass stop, then hop on a free shuttle bus to the JFK Library. The Commonwealth Museum is only 2 doors down. For the winter season, the hours are 9 to 4:30, Monday through Friday. But from May to October, the museum will also be open on weekends from 9 to 3. Admission is always free.
The museum's flanked on either side by remnants of Boston's first modern sewage system. In the 1880s, the city implemented its first plan for centralized sewage treatment, instead of just draining the sewage into the nearest convenient body of water. Large sewage mains were built to intercept existing drains, and the mains all led to Columbia Point, which was then just known as the Calf Pasture. A large granite building that looks like a castle, or maybe a prison, remains on Columbia Point about 100 yards northwest of the Commonwealth Museum, just across an overflow parking lot. This building was the main pumping station that would pump all the sewage from the growing city of Boston through a tunnel under Dorchester Bay to Moon Island. On Moon Island, the sewage was treated and released on the receding tide. Across the street to the east of the museum is the Boston Harbor Walk, and on a grassy knoll above the Harbor Walk is a small, round brick building. This was a pumping house that was the last stop for sewage that was entering the tunnel to Moon Island. The Moon Island treatment facility has long since been replaced by the modern, much cleaner Deer Island treatment plant. The old granite treatment and holding tanks on Moon Island are now used as firing ranges for the Boston Police Department. While you're on Columbia Point, you might as well take a moment to appreciate the last remaining 19th century structures in the area and the last reminders of our early attempts to deal with Boston's sewage problems. Speaking of things you might as well do while you're on Columbia Point,
for our upcoming event this week, we're sticking to the theme of Boston, or the U.S., in 1968. The John F. Kennedy Presidential Library is located almost next door to the Commonwealth Museum on Columbia Point. And on March 20th, the JFK Library will be hosting a forum called Vietnam 1968, The War, the Turmoil, and the Presidential Election. It will be hosted by Lawrence O'Donnell, Frederick Loegwal, Christian Appy, and Ellen Fitzpatrick, all of whom are well-known historians of the Vietnam War. Lawrence O'Donnell is also a television personality, hosting the MSNBC show Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. They'll be discussing events in the Vietnam War during 1968, events in domestic American politics in 1968, and the interplay between the two. 1968 was the year of the Tet Offensive and the My Lai Massacre. It was the year Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated, of George Wallace's segregationist campaign and the Civil Rights Act, and of violent clashes at the Democratic National Convention and the rise of Richard Nixon. The forum is part of the National Archives Remembering Vietnam Initiative, and the program will be introduced by David S. Ferrero, Archivist of the United States. The event is free, but advanced registration is strongly recommended in order to get a seat in the main hall. In what we believe is a first for one of our featured events, the forum will feature a live webcast, so you can follow along from home. We'll have links to information about registration and the webcast in this week's show notes.
All right, it's time for this week's main event. We're here today with Ryan Walsh, the author of the new book, Astral Weeks, A Secret History of 1968, which is coming out this week. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So the book's called Astral Weeks, and that's named after a record by Van Morrison. In the book, you say that you encountered the record when you were 22 years old. Was it new to you then, or were you discovering it after the fact?
No, that's when I first heard of it and heard the music on it. It was all in one moment when I was very sadly browsing a record store, and I can't quite explain it. I just wanted to buy it and take it home, and I did, and it, and then it's been part of my life ever since, in one way or the other.
So, what hooked you about this record? What made it so compelling that you ended up writing a book based on your experience with this record?
Well, it was a really slow burn. I mean, for the first thing that happened was I just kept listening to it, and I didn't think critically about it at all. I didn't think about how it was made. I just really was kind of mesmerized and moved by the music. It's just this beautiful, poetic, circular album that didn't sound like anything else I knew. And also, I liked how you couldn't really pin a, you know, you put on a Jefferson Airplane record from the same year, and anyone can say that's a record from the late 60s. And this has a timeless quality where you don't quite know when it was recorded. It could kind of be any time. And then what happened was a drips and drabs of info I just stumbled upon indicating that he, Van Morrison, lived in Boston right before he made this record, which didn't make any sense to me.
So, Ryan, for those of us who really only know Brown Eyed Girl,
yeah,
can you just tell us a little bit about who Van Morrison was and kind of his significance in the music industry?
Well, I mean, at the time he had found a good amount of success with his band from Belfast, Them. They, you know, they had Baby Please Don't Go. They had a couple minor radio hits, and they had done a tour of the States. And Morrison hooked up with American producer Burt Burns after Them kind of disbanded, and they cut Brown Eyed Girl together. And it's right about that time that I pick up the story, because that's when he's about to unexpectedly land in Boston, Cambridge. I kind of use Boston, Cambridge. I interchange them, much to the chagrin of some people. But
just for today, we can say that they're
interchangeable. Thank you. By the time he got here, he was trying to reinvent himself. He was kind of living hand to mouth and not sure what was going to happen next. And he fled that record deal in New York because there were some associated people with the label who were mobsters, and he was scared.
So Van Morrison is in New York. He's worried about the situation with his record label because it's infested with mobsters. How does he then decide to come to Boston and then stay in Boston long enough to record a record here?
According to his wife at the time, Janet Planet, there was a manager in Boston who said, why don't you move here and we'll kind of figure out your career together. There was also a very vibrant folk scene that Dylan had slight ties to, and Van kind of worshiped Dylan. It just seemed like a good, at least temporary, place to hole up. And so, you know, he ends up staying here 6 to 8 months, but they're a really important 6 to 8 months, and he's super busy, and he hooks up with all these Boston musicians and trying to piece together that spring and summer leading up to the recording of Astral Weeks is what the book is, half the book's concerned with, I'd say.
So speaking of the folk scene and the influence of Dylan around here, you open the book describing Mel Lyman's performance at the famous Newport Folk Festival where Dylan went electric. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what Mel Lyman's performance there was like, but also who Mel Lyman is or was?
Sure. Well, I started the book with that story because everyone knows that story. It's so like etched into rock and roll history. But when I found out that, you know, there was this epilogue to his performance where the skinny kid got up and did a harmonica dirge to mourn the death of folk music because Dylan had the balls to go electric. That was just like, it was like seeing a new part of a story I thought I knew all about. And, you know, less than a year after that performance, Lyman ended up kind of collecting, renting, buying all these houses in Roxbury together in a row and started kind of building a non-orthodox family there, starting an underground newspaper and telling people that he was God.
Now, that community he builds in Fort Hill in Roxbury is really a through line throughout the book. You keep coming back to it to tie the different threads of your story about 1968 together, which I really latched on to because we recently featured Fort Hill as our historic location of the week just a few weeks ago. And we were talking about it because of its Revolutionary War history, but then also because the Fort Hill Tower started out as a water tower, and it was very symbolic in 1868 as the sort of services that the surrounding cities like Roxbury and Dorchester could get if they joined the city of Boston. So I really want to sort of pull this out a little bit. how was Mel Lyman creating this community, and how did that sort of become the epicenter of weirdness in Boston in the late 60s?
Well, by all accounts, he was, he was a talented harmonica banjo player, but he was also very charismatic. And, through his charisma and through his confidence and through the help of LSD, people were attracted to go up there and kind of live in this family with them, which by, I think, 68, there was anywhere from 50 to 100 people living in those houses together as a community at the time. And what happened was he was also connected to, you know, what becomes the Boston Tea Party, which is the first famous rock venue in Boston. And the Boston Globe was basically just obsessed with the Tea Party, the Fort Hill community, and Lyman. They just keep writing about him. So that someone was that famous, infamous then, and then by the time I get to the story, the name is pretty much completely forgotten. That was interesting to me. Like, why? What happened? Where did it go? You know? And so, the Lyman story and the Van Morrison story are kind of our two through lines throughout the book, because they're both musicians in the same area, same year, kind of trying to reach some kind of answer about spirituality and using music as a big way to try to find the answers.
And Ryan, was he famous or infamous? I mean, you mentioned that the Globe was obsessed with him. Like, certainly this wasn't a secretive thing happening. You know, did people take him seriously?
Various people, everyone took him differently as far as I can tell. I mean, some people took him very seriously, those who lived around him, for instance. And then, you know, the newspapers, they were very genuinely curious. It was an infamous kind of thing. I mean, he was incendiary. There's the whole obscenity trial around what he's saying in the Avatar newspaper. He seemed to be a good magnet for scandal.
So you mentioned they're publishing an underground newspaper called Avatar. What's the beat of Avatar? What do they cover in this newspaper?
Oh, what don't they cover in Avatar? It was a really wild kind of collage-y newspaper. When I first started working on the story, I ended up buying the complete set of all the issues they published from, you know, the Fort Hill community people who still live up there to this day. You can basically go up and fork over $400 and then you have every Avatar that came out. So I started wading through this pile of these underground countercultural newspapers from 67, 68. And there's everything from, you know, coverage of local music scene to a lot of material on astrology to letters to Mel, photos of Mel, one regular article on sexuality. And then, you know, some straight kind of politics coverage too. So it's really a mishmash of all kinds of subjects and really a direct precursor to things like, you know, the Boston Phoenix, which would appear as the Cambridge Phoenix just a couple years later.
Now, you mentioned that you can go up to the compound today. Can you give us a sense of, you know, what it looked like back then, and you know what life was like there in 1968?
Mm-hmm. Very run down. people all, you know, it's a beautiful neighborhood now and kind of in demand. But back then, it was the park surrounding the tower was covered in broken glass. There's a reason they were able to kind of collect these houses all in a row. It's because they were, you know, barely standing or, you know, bargain basement prices, you know, just trying to get rid of this property. And also it was in the middle of what's predominantly an African-American neighborhood. So the idea that these majority of the family was Caucasian, white, that they just moved into the middle of this neighborhood. There was tensions around that too.
So you mentioned the racial tensions in the neighborhood when the Fort Hill community, the Mel Lyman community, moved into Fort Hill. And you really highlight that in your chapter about the assassination of Martin Luther King and then the ensuing James Brown concert. I think most of our listeners will know at least something about the April 1968 James Brown concert that people credit with preventing violence after the MLK assassination. But you go into a lot of depth. You go from Puritan Boston and in just a few paragraphs right up to Mayor Kevin White. Can you give us just a thumbnail sketch of who Kevin White was, sort of his background, his campaign against Louise Day Hicks, and then how Boston saw Mayor Kevin White on the race issue going into 1968?
Sure. Mayor Kevin White beat Hicks. She was basically an openly racist candidate for mayor. I think her motto was, "You know where I stand." That was a signal to people who liked the old Boston, segregated Boston. So White narrowly defeated her. And then, you know, a lot of people think of his run as mayor as an attempt to be progressive. I mean, oftentimes white people would say he's doing too much for the black community, and the black community would say he's just lip serving us, providing us lip service. He's not actually helping us. So he was criticized by both sides, but seems to me that he was doing, you know, trying certainly much harder than his opponent would have if she had taken office.
So how does Kevin White and I guess the city decide to try to use the James Brown concert that's already scheduled for the night after the Martin Luther King Jr. assassination? How do they decide to try to use that to head off what they see as a potential riot in Boston? What was the plan for that night?
Well, after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, you know, everyone was in turmoil. Everyone was panicked, especially leaders of large metropolises. What's going to happen? Will there be riots? Now, Mayor White was not – the James Brown concert was so off his radar. Councilman Tom Atkins, who is an African-American, tipped him off to – A, what the concert was, and B, why it's potentially problematic. Because, you know, if you cancel that show, people are going to be upset. If you gather people there at that show with a performer like James Brown, that could also be trouble. So there was a lot of back and forth. What should we do? What should we do? And then one of Mayor White's top aides, Barney Frank, finally had the idea of, what if the concert went on, but we broadcast it live on GBH so people could stay home and still watch it? And it was like a Hail Mary move of, let's try something and try to keep the peace and the calm here in the city.
So if there had been unrest that night, or if there had been a riot around the James Brown concert, that wouldn't be the only instance of that in Boston's history. I think some of our listeners might be familiar with the 1994 Green Day riot at the Hatch Shell. Some of our listeners may have been there.
I was there.
One of my best friends was there. I was not. I was not yet a Bostonian at that point. Other people might know the 1975 Led Zeppelin riot. Uh-huh. But you, in the book, you highlight some unrest around rock and roll music that goes back much further than that. Before we get back into the James Brown show, can you just tell us briefly about the early relationship with rock and roll Boston had going back to the 1950s and Alan Freed?
Right, yes. So in that point in the book where the city is worried about a riot and it's tied to a rock concert, I kind of rewinded 10, 15 years to trace this strange string of incidents. There was a lot of rock and roll riots in Boston. There was, in fact, one mayor banned rock concerts altogether at some point. And in fact,
and then was that successful?
No, I mean, but there was, you know, there was the city censor, a gentleman named, last name Sinnott, was in charge of deciding what acts were rock and which weren't, which is a bizarre thing if you think about it. Like, I found a newspaper which quoted him as like wondering out loud if the Beach Boys were rock or not. He's like, some people call them folk. Anyways, the James Brown concert was booked without any trouble for reasons no one quite remembers. But yes, Alan Freed famously in the late 50s, was it late 50s?
I think it was 1956 in the book, but I don't have it open in front of me right now.
Alan Freed, through the, you know, he was a famous DJ, and he would put together bills of rock bands and kind of travel around with it. And in Boston, the rumor was, he said something from the stage like, you know, the Boston cops don't want you to have fun. And kids just went berserk. I guess outside the show, after the show, is when it all happened. So in the book, I just tried to retrace all of these little rock and roll riot incidences that kind of culminate in this James Brown concert.
Now, you said that the concert was televised on WGBH. And I'll just mention here that almost the whole telecast is available on YouTube, and we will drop a link to that in the show notes this week for anybody who's listening who wants to see that.
Mm-hmm. Now, for those who might go to YouTube and watch the telecast, at the end, they'll see that James Brown introduces Mayor White as a swinging cat. Was Kevin White actually a swinging cat?
Probably not. I mean, I think that's James Brown being very generous and kind. I mean, they had a lot of back and forth backstage before the show. And, you know, Mayor White claims that he basically demanded that Brown go out with a message of peace and nonviolence. And, I mean, Mayor White seems maybe more open-minded and looser than a lot of politicians, but I don't think anyone who encountered him outside of extraordinary circumstances like that Brown concert might identify him as a swinging cat.
Well, it's not a descriptor that stuck. Like, that didn't make it into the campaign materials, so.
It didn't, but he kind of repeated a similar thing a few years later when the Rolling Stones were arrested in Rhode Island for drug possession.
Oh, I forgot that was Kevin White.
Yeah, he kind of played, the audience was already at the venue. He stood on stage and played football, throwing the football into the audience with them for like 2 hours waiting for the Stones to get there.
And he had to personally intervene with the Providence cops to try and get them sprung on, I think it was drug possession charges, to be able to make the show that evening, right?
Correct on all counts, yes, yeah.
So there is a lot of back and forth in that telecast toward the end, and that both James Brown and Kevin White address the audience about Martin Luther King and sort of what's going on in the wider world that evening. Kevin White says something along the lines, he refers back to Martin Luther King's time as a student in Boston and says that it's up to our generation to prove his faith in our city. What was the mood in the city like that night? What kind of precautions were being taken as that show was coming to an end?
Well, the interesting thing is the reports from around the city said that the city was a ghost town. People were at that show or watching at home or just at home, you know, watching whatever or not watching, you know, reading or mourning or praying. There were some scattered incidents, but really it was a quiet night in the city, and people credit that concert for kind of inspiring that piece. Other cities, DC, Chicago, there were riots, fires, burning. So it was kind of a musical miracle that James Brown pulled off in that concert. And I, you know, you can watch it to this day. I defy you to watch it to this day. And when kids start running up on stage and the cops start coming out on the stage, I know how it ends, but I still watch it and I get nervous, anxious.
Yeah, it seems like a very nervous night in Boston all around. And in the book, you described that it was a very nervous night on Fort Hill that night. Can you tell us a little bit about how Mel Lyman's so-called family reacted to the assassination of Martin Luther King?
Right. Well, like I said, they were the community was predominantly white people in the middle of a African-American neighborhood. And, you know, lines were being drawn very quickly after the assassination. And they got word, the Fort Hill community, the Lyman family, got word that the Black Panthers were literally going to set all their houses on fire and get them out of the neighborhood once and for all. And when I interviewed Jessie Benton, who was Mel Lyman's wife at the time, she spoke of how Lyman sent her to negotiate with Black Panthers, and they somehow reached a resolution, and that those fires did not happen. But everything seemed very volatile, and no one knew how this was all going to go down. It was an extremely, extremely tense time in the city.
Now, sticking with Mel Lyman and his community for a minute, I want to sort of switch gears and talk a little bit more about the psychedelic era that was really reaching its peak in 1968. You mentioned in the book that Mel Lyman seemed to use LSD to try to keep his flock under some sort of control. And then you wrap that into a larger chapter about hallucinogens and the wider psychedelic movement in Boston. Can you tell us a little bit about what you learned about the very early experiments with LSD at the Boston Psychiatric Hospital?
Sure. Well, you know, most people will, if they're talking about early hallucinogenic use in American counterculture, they'll probably start with, you know, Tim Leary in Harvard. But what was interesting to me is that there was 10 years of history before that, 10 plus. And in fact, the first LSD dose administered to someone in America happened at a Boston hospital in the Fenway area, where there was a lecture given at the hospital by a Swiss doctor. I don't know if you or your listeners know, but the compound LSD was synthesized first by a Swiss chemist named Albert Hoffman. So, not Hoffman, but it's a different doctor, told these Boston doctors, listen, we found this chemical that mimics schizophrenia. It'll help you study schizophrenia. You can make one of your patients temporarily schizophrenic. So, these Boston doctors said, well, that sounds interesting. Let's order some. And they did. And they began these experiments using LSD. And at first, it's purely medical, but, you know, a few years into it, I read one account where they spiked the hospital Christmas party punch bowl with it. I mean, which is pretty ill-advised party at a hospital, if you ask me. But then,
yeah, that's a bad trip.
Yeah. So that's kind of ground zero of LSD use in America, right here in Boston. And from there, I mean, it gets, you know, it gets very strange. The CIA becomes interested in the substance, and now suddenly they're funding the Boston doctors' experiments with LSD. And this is all in the years leading up to Tim Leary at Harvard. Which is, you know, of course, a very famous story where he was basically given a go-ahead by Harvard to give grad students psilocybin, which is another hallucinogen. That's the synthesized form of what you call magic mushrooms. And I'll tack onto that. So, yeah, I in that chapter, I start way back in the 50s with the first dose of LSD, and I go from the CIA to Harvard to Tim Leary to Richard Alpert, and then Richard Alpert's story ends up intersecting with Mel Lyman's because he ends up going over to Alpert's house in Newton to partake in these experiments.
So I actually wanted to dig a little deeper into that. In the chapter on the psychedelic movement, there are two figures. There's Richard Alpert, who seems to be on one end of a continuum of sort of how to approach hallucinogens. And then on the other side, you have Lisa Biberman of the Psychedelic Information Center. And so you have one who's a very no-nonsense approach, kind of like the high school nurse's office approach. And then the other ends up having this mystical experience in India and reinventing himself with an entirely new persona. Can you talk a little bit about each of those figures?
Sure. So Tim Leary and Richard Alpert, they start the IFIF out of Harvard, and their secretary is a woman named Lisa Biberman.
And so, yes, sorry to interrupt. Tell me what the IFIF is.
Oh, the International Federation for Internal Freedom, I think. It's it's basically the foundation they start after Harvard kicks them out. They want to continue exploring these substances, and they start the IFIF. And I was familiar with the story, but I had never heard of Lisa Biberman. And it was interesting to kind of try to tell a bit of this story from her perspective, because she was, you know, she started out their secretary, but as they got further out there and, you know, kind of moved to a giant mansion in upstate New York, Lisa Biberman kept the lights on and tried to be very matter of fact about how to use these drugs and, you know, created charts that we would find laughable today, like how high are you? It would be like the y-axis would be like how much did you take, and the x-axis would be like when did you take it. And Lisa Biberman kind of in 68 she kind of says goodbye to the scene. She thinks it's corrupted. She feels like she had a mystical experience and was shown some beautiful things, but she kind of walks away from LSD and the scene surrounding it. Her story, I mean, I leave her story there in 68. If anyone's interested, they should Google her name, because her life actually gets weirder after that. It's too long for me to go into here, but if you're interested, do look her name up.
Well, that's quite a tease. So on the other hand, there we have Richard Alpert, and he started out working with Timothy Leary at Harvard, start with what started out as very serious research into LSD, right?
Absolutely, yes. They're giving this substance to prisoners. They're giving this substance to divinity students in the basement of Marsh Chapel. And Alpert is younger than Leary, and he comes from, you know, a well-off family from Massachusetts. His father, I think, co-founded Brandeis. And Alpert was, kind of a buttoned-up guy. And then he partook in the experiment himself, took LSD, and, you know, had a life-changing experience. And Alpert's story is very interesting because at a certain point, he bottoms out with experimenting with hallucinogens. And he just has this feeling that, well, this is good, but the experience always ends, and it's hard to bring back into regular existence what I'm learning and experiencing while I'm high. So Alpert goes to India to try to find himself or something, and ends up undergoing this spiritual conversion, and returns to America in 68, shaved head, wearing robes, and calling himself Ram Dass. And Ram Dass, of course, is still alive today. He's one of the most famous American spiritual leaders. And, you know, that transformation is pretty interesting to me. And so I tried to tell that story in the book as well.
And then you say that his life intersected again with Mel Lyman's, and I might have overlooked that section in the book. Can you tell us a little bit about how the two of them came back together?
Oh, sure. Well, if we rewind back to 62, I think is the year after Leary and Alpert are fired from Harvard, the experiments then kind of shifted over into Leary and Alpert's homes, personal homes in Newton, which became like little mini communes. And Lyman, for some reason or another, knew someone associated with the house and started to go to the Alpert's Newton home on Kenwood, 23 Kenwood. And that's where he started having a lot of psychedelic experiences and introducing other people to psychedelics too.
Let's switch topics now, because one thing that Jake and I both learned about that we really knew nothing of was this Bosstown sound and the idea that there was a push to create a new genre of music here in Boston. So I'd love to talk just a little bit about, you know, what that sounded like. But first, really curious, why is the chapter called Paul Revere is Shamed?
The chapter is called Paul Revere is Shamed because that was one of the captions of the photos in this Rolling Stone article about the Bosstown sound. And it just struck me as so cruel and unusual. Like, why do that? That that we decided, my editor and I decided that we would use it as the chapter title. And it's all
that cuts right to the heart of our Boston identity. Right?
I know, yeah. And it's also, you know, we used it because, you know, a lot of the stories in the book, they echo back to even further time back in Boston history. And so that was just a good way to keep that echo going.
Now, were there bands that were part of the Bosstown sound that the average listener might have come across?
Well, I don't know who your average listener is, but for instance, when I was explaining it to my parents, I went with the radio hit Orpheus Can't Find the Time, and I started to sing it to them, and they finished the chorus for me. So they knew that one. And I think that was, you know, by Radio Metrics. That band, that song was probably the most well known. But essentially, what this chapter is about, what this story is that the record industry had a tremendous success with the San Francisco sound, which was the Grateful Dead, Jefferson Airplane. This was a natural West Coast scene that was legitimate, that was grassroots, grew naturally, people loved, and you know, there was money to be made there for record companies. So there became a moment where it was like, where next? Where's the next city? What's the next sound? And when one didn't present itself, one gentleman named Alan Lorber decided, well, I'll just pick the city and then build from there. And he saw Boston, you know, rich with college students, and worked with MGM Records to pick three bands, record a debut album with each of them, and call it the Bosstown Sound.
So it really wasn't authentic at all then in the way that San Francisco was.
The idea that it was a unified scene or a sound, no. Now, the kids in these bands, they are just young musicians with dreams of making it in a rock band, you know? It was the jamming together and the packaging of it and the naming. You know, you listen to those three records. The three first bands were Ultimate Spinach, Beacon Street Union, and Orpheus in the original promotions from MGM. And if you listen to those three bands, they don't sound anything like each other. So if that's the Bosstown sound, it was, you know, it was confusing from the get-go. And I was interested in telling the story of it because it just kind of got crazier and crazier. And also, it's kind of one of the first times the counterculture smelled a marketing rat from a mile away. You know, like, I'm just being sold something here. And
that's a pattern that had repeat itself in Boston and lots of other cities. I know I can think right after Godsmack really broke out of the Boston scene in, what would that have been, like 2000-ish?
Yeah.
Then there were agents just everywhere. I worked in clubs at the time. I was friends with some musicians around Boston, and it seemed like everybody was looking for the next... It wasn't the Bosstown sound, but people were looking for the next Boston rock band to sort of step in to that Godsmack-sized shoes.
Sure. I mean, it just speaks... It speaks to the mindset of record executives, at least at one time. I don't think so much anymore, but it's just like, it's almost like someone who strikes gold in a riverbed. They just think, okay, we'll go there, you know. And it's kind of not. You should always search for music that sounds good and interesting to start that kind of project, instead of like pointing to a certain spot in the map and like, I bet all the bands are there. I mean, that's just not a good idea.
Now, I have one burning question based on a section I read in the book. Comedian Chevy Chase was a Bosstown drummer. Is that right?
Well, he wasn't from Boston, but he ended up in a Bosstown sound band called Chameleon Church. He was friends with a guy named Ted Myers, who was in a great Boston band called The Lost. And then after The Lost, he, started this band called Chameleon Church, which was produced by Alan Lorber and part of the Bosstown sound. And Chevy was the drummer. And, you know, what is this, you know, 10 years before his, breakout as an SNL, comedian.
That is truly amazing. I will try to find something from Chameleon Church to drop into this week's show notes so people can hear what that sounded like.
Sure, yeah. I mean, their music's on Spotify and YouTube, I believe. And, you know, it was interesting when I was researching this, I found one biography of Chevy Chase where someone asked him about his turn as a Bosstown sound musician. And he just very glibly said, well, all my bandmates were junkies and they're probably all dead. And I showed that to Ted. And he was like, he was so mad, you know, none of us were junkies. All of us are alive, you know, and it was, it's just.
So it's not a body of work that Chevy Chase stands behind now.
No, not at all. Yeah.
It's like Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch.
That's right, yeah.
Woe to the journalist who brings that up.
I know, right?
So, Ryan, I think our listeners will discern that you yourself are a musician, and you're also a music journalist, and now you've written this book. So can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, how all of those three things play together?
Sure. Let's see. I went to college, Boston University, for film. I thought that's what I was going to do, was screenwriting or film editing. That was like kind of one of my first creative interests. But near the end of college, music opportunities just kept popping up, and I started a band. My first band was called The Stairs. And that ended in 2005, and I started a band called Hallelujah the Hills, which still exists to this day. And then throughout all of that time, all that music, I would occasionally write different kinds of articles. I've always enjoyed writing. I wrote for the Phoenix here and there. And though all of these interests is kind of dovetailed together when I finally knew enough about Van Morrison in Cambridge that I thought I could make an interesting article for Boston Magazine. And that was in 2014.
So you started out with an article, but it sounds like you ended up with a book. How did that happen?
Well, the article came out in spring of 2015, and it was quite popular. People shared it a bunch. People really responded quite positively to it. And an editor at Penguin Books, who is also obsessed with the album Astral Weeks, reached out to me and said, hey, let's chat about how this could be a full book. And we chatted for a long time about how to do it. And eventually we came upon this idea of the entire city, the entire year, various stories with Van and Mel strung throughout each, drifting through each story in some way. And I just couldn't believe it when Penguin agreed to publish it. And that's what, and I've been hard at work, you know, basically for 2+ years on this. So I actually can't believe it's about to come out. I had convinced myself for a while I would just work on it forever and no one would ever read it.
Well, Ryan, is there anything else meaty that you want to make sure we get in here?
Because your excellent podcast is about the history of the city, I'll tell you one thing in the research that really surprised me about the city, and that is that it was a mecca for spiritualism and the occult in the 1800s.
Now I've thought about putting together, you know, a Halloween episode around that, particularly around the ghost photography,
right,
that was taking place at that time.
Yeah, I think his name was Mumler.
Yeah. On Washington Street.
Spirit photography is invented here. The Boston planchette is kind of a precursor to the Ouija board craze. There were all these halls around town dedicated.
There was a medium at the base of Beacon Hill, too, right on Lime Street.
Yeah, the Witch of Lime Street. It was a lot of famous mediums, and then Houdini's obsessed with debunking them. It was just like this incredibly weird, rich history that I had never heard a whisper of. So as far as things that truly surprised me, that was one of them.
Maybe we'll have you back for our Halloween episode.
Oh, I'd be glad to do it. Sure. And, you know, I hope people enjoy the book. I think whether they're from Boston or not, or whether they like these musicians, I tried to write it in a way where it's just a really good story. And now that's up to the readers to decide. So I will sit back quietly while people read.
So when this episode comes out, we're going to be just a few days away from the release of the book on March 6th. Are you doing any signings, or are there events in Boston where people can come out and meet you?
Sure. The day of publication, March 6th, that evening, I'll be at Brookline Booksmith, talking about the book with Carly Carioli, who was the original editor at Boston Magazine, who said yes to the original article. And we'll do Q&A and book signing. And yeah, please come out.
So Ryan, what's the best way for people to follow you online, or how should they get in touch with you?
People can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jahills, J-A-H-H-I-L-L-S. And I have two websites, one for music and one for the book, astralweeks.net. More info about the book. And you can find my band at hallelujahthehills.com.
All right, folks, that was author Ryan H. Walsh. And the new book is Astral Weeks, A Secret History of 1968. Ryan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
To learn more about Ryan's book, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/070. We'll have a link to buy the book, some YouTube videos of Bosstown sound bands, the telecast of that famous 1968 James Brown concert at Boston Garden, and links to Ryan's website and social media. We'll also have a link to his author event at Brookline Booksmith, our favorite bookstore, this Tuesday, March 6th. And of course, we'll have links to information about this week's featured historic site and upcoming event.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We are Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the
show. That's all for now. We'll be back next week.